You are listening to the Unusually Well-Informed Podcast.
Welcome to the Unusually Well-Informed Podcast. I'm your host, Tim Hampton. My unusually well-informed guest today is Stacy Ashley. Stacy is a high-performance leadership and coaching expert. Stacy has helped thousands of people develop their leadership competence, confidence, and credibility. She's the author of 5 number one best-selling books on leadership. Today, Stacy and I are discussing her book titled Show Up 21, 5 Practical Ways to Activate Your Leadership and Rise to the Challenge. Stacy, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Tim. I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
I have been as well. Me too. Stacy, you have been speaking and coaching leaders for over 15 years. How has the turmoil of the last 2 years changed or affected your thinking about leadership?
I think for me, it actually probably hasn't changed my thinking about leadership. What I've noticed, though, is it's changed a lot of other people's thinking about leadership. And so some of the things that I believe have been important for a really long time are now getting, you know, more coverage, you know, things like empathy and kindness and humanity in leadership and, you know, leading from the heart rather than just head-based thinking. They're the themes that we're all hearing: connection, trust, all of those things that perhaps were there but not really highlighted perhaps as much as they are now. That for me has been the shift. And so I'm really excited by that, because I think that just creates opportunity, because now what we're doing is we're seeing leaders really appreciate the full breadth of, you know, what they need and what they can do and contribute.
How do you distinguish between leadership and management? Do you see a distinction between the two?
To some degree, yes. And I think the way that I sort of talk about it is that people can do both, you know, have some management approach and some leadership approach. And really it's about the balance between kind of the task and the people. And what I find is that kind of early in career, it's kind of quite a lot of about task. You know, what do we need to do? When do we need to do it? Whereas as people progress in their career, they become more involved in, you know, the bigger picture, the vision, the how do I bring out the best in my people? And so their focus on actually getting stuff done perhaps reduces, and their focus on helping their people to get stuff done increases. That's really how I see it. So I think it's sort of a blend of both, and it moves as your leadership perhaps matures.
Yeah, that's a great definition. In your book, Show Up 21, you make the point that things have not returned to normal, and that the turmoil of the last 2 years is sort of ongoing. How are leaders coping?
A mixed bag. I think you've probably seen it yourself. Some are just incredible. They seem to have the ability to really be able to look for the opportunities, find the opportunities, even in really, you know, challenging circumstances, to be able to lead their people, keep them connected, and support themselves at the same time, which I think is really key, because, you know, they've got to be able to keep re-energizing so that they can keep giving. Right through, you know, there's a big spectrum, and then there are leaders or people who are in leadership roles who have really been challenged and struggled, and there's nothing wrong with that, because for many leaders this is a whole new game. You know, they haven't had to face into so many challenges so quickly and so many variables and so many, you know, and nobody gave them the playbook on this. And so I think it's okay to be struggling. The question is, you know, what do you do differently or next to move out of that struggle?
Yeah. Well, you make an excellent point, and that is that it's very hard to lead if you're not at your best. And that's one of the points from the book. Depending on where you live or work, you may find the activities that you rely on to re-energize are really curtailed. You're locked in place, or some places are not available to go to. And on top of that, many of us are quite anxious and tired. What can we do to maintain our resilience in these difficult times?
I think step one is be aware of it. How's my energy? How am I feeling? How's my, you know, how am I thinking? Is it is there enough positive stuff going on or not? And just so being quite self-observant, I think, is the first thing, and just notice. And so if things perhaps are not quite balanced enough, or you're feeling, you know, just a bit flat, those sorts of things, then look for the small opportunities about, you know, what can I do for myself? And it might be something small, you know, things that add to your energy. So for me, I'll give you an example. For me, I need to get outside. If I don't get outside, my energy starts to drop. And so if I'm in lockdown, that may mean that I actually just walk out on the balcony and get some fresh air, as opposed to going for a nice long walk, you know, through the bush. But look for those small opportunities. If you feel like you're in meeting after meeting after meeting and it's super draining, which we know it is, you know, and all the research tells us it is, then create opportunities, little spaces in your calendar so that you can have a 5-minute break and you can have a 10-minute break. And those little things do a couple of things for you. They give you those little opportunities to re-energize, but they also put you back in control to some degree. And the loss of control, the feeling like I don't have any power in my situation, is one of the biggest things that really impacts people's energy and ability to show up. So just those little things that you can do for yourself kind of have a twofold effect. And so it doesn't have to be the big, I've got to take a week off or 2 weeks off or anything. Just do the little things, because they're all going to help you.
So you talk a little bit about, you know, taking those breaks for things that are energizing. The problem is that a lot of us take breaks and do things that are not energizing. Like, you know, in everything's fine in moderation, but Netflix and potato chips may not be, you know, perfect. How do you maintain your resilience in terms of the strength of will to do things that are really productive and energizing?
Yeah, good question. I think there's a couple of things. One is, again, be observant. How do I feel after I've done Netflix in every single one of my breaks, or I've eaten food that I know is not fantastic and I've consistently eaten it rather than just having it as a treat? How do I want to feel? And that's the same, you know, it's all about how important is it to you to feel better, to be energized, to want to show up as a leader. That's what I would be focused on. And if you need to track it for a little while to see the difference between eating chips every break and, you know, eating healthy every break, or hydrating or whatever it is you do, I think there's that, you know, because if you're in lockdown or, you know, you're working from home and you haven't had contact with people, it can be hard to maintain your focus. I'm not belittling that at all. So figure out for yourself, why is this important to me? You know, and for some people, it will be about their contribution as a leader. For some people, it'll be just like, I'm sick of feeling like this. I really want to feel a bit different. Or somewhere in the middle, you know, lots of other reasons. You know, am I supporting my family or my friends or my whatever? So tapping into why this is important to me, what's the difference it would make, but also then what's the difference I can make as a consequence? If I look after myself, what does that mean I can now do and be? I think is really important. But the other thing, which can be really helpful when we're trying to stick, you know, stay the course, is create some kind of accountability for yourself. And that could be you track it yourself, you know, you just keep a little record of it. And maybe you do give yourself a reward. If you do what you said you would do, then you get your treat or whatever. Or get an accountability buddy. You know, maybe there's someone else that you know, whether it's in your own household or your own team or just another friend, somebody else who will support you or perhaps also needs support, so you can support each other to be accountable and know that because you're doing that, you're creating some connection and that sort of thing, which is good for us. But also that both of you are going to be then in a better place to be able to support yourselves and the people around you. And, you know, that's leadership in times of you know, challenge, isn't it? Is that it's all about supporting the people around us.
Well, I love the way you frame that, because you began with the question of why, like tapping into what's important to you. And there's such a strong connection between self-leadership and leadership of an organization. You know, this idea that in the day to day, in the cut and thrust and all the turmoil, it's easy to lose sight of why we're doing what we're doing.
Yeah.
That's great absolutely. Advice.
And I think that's happened a lot. You know, there's been this real disconnect. Everyone's just been like frantically scrambling. What do we do? How do we do it? You know, that we can easily get caught in that and forget to look at the horizon, forget to look at the big picture, the purpose. And so you're right. Yeah. Connecting to why it, on so many levels, has value.
Something you just said made me think that a minor epiphany, if you will, and that is that when I look around, I see people desperately trying to get back to normal. Mm. And it's natural when you're knocked off course to want to sort of return to course. Mm. But wherever you're knocked to, you still have your North Star, which is the why. What are your thoughts on this mania about getting back to normal? Is it, should that be our focus, or how should we respond to that impulse? It's in ourselves and in our organizations.
Mm, interesting. And I've seen it too. Absolutely. The thing is, we're never going back to 2019, right? Never.
Yeah.
And I think deep down, everybody kind of knows that. And so to go back in on course, that doesn't even exist anymore. So you could spend a lot of energy trying to do that and create something that just simply isn't there and is no longer relevant. Like if you sort of got to do what you were doing, how you were doing it, where you were doing it, with who you were doing it back in 2019, if you do that now, it's no longer relevant. Yeah. Like the world has changed. The way we work has changed. What people appreciate and notice has changed. How we run our businesses has changed. So I think it's, yeah, keep your focus on that North Star, as you described it, and look at what are my options now to get on a track that leads to that. You know, and yes, there are going to be course corrections along the way. We know the change is not going to slow down. If anything, the last 2 years has taught us that change is only going to continue to accelerate. And so we have to master that rather than trying to get back to something we're familiar with. Master the ability to actually thrive in that space, so that there isn't that desire to put energy into something that doesn't create value, like get back to what it used to be, and to look at how do I be relevant? How do I contribute? How, you know, what are my options? How do I work with the people around me that take us forward?
Great. So in the book, you use the concept of Dunbar's number to frame mm-hmm. the connections we have with people, you know, this concentric mm. rings of people we're closest mm. to, and then larger numbers as we go out. Mm. How can we use this? The goal, of course, of thinking along these lines is to maximize the value that we bring to these connections, that we get from mm. these connections. How can we do this when so many of us are physically disconnected?
Yeah, good question. Again, thinking differently, like what are my options? How can I connect? What do they need from me in terms of connection? What do I need from them? And then do that. And so connection doesn't have to be, I have to have a face-to-face meeting, I've got to have a phone call all the time. So, you know, think a little bit differently. You know, is there some generational requirements in there? Probably, because each of the generations, you know, is used to communicating in different ways. So be aware of that, you know, when you figure out what you're going to do. But I think the important thing that I've noticed anyway, both for myself and for the people that I'm working with, is just make the effort, mm-hmm. reach out to people. The act of reaching out to people, whether it's a text, whether it's a, you know, a message on LinkedIn, whether it's a phone call, whatever it might be, the act of reaching out is beginning the process of creating connection, and people really appreciate it. The longer you leave that reaching out, of course, the harder it's going to get. But I think, you know, so act now. And it's, for me, that's the key, isn't it? Like, reach out. If you don't, nothing's going to happen. It may not be the way they want to be reached out to, but at least you might find that out. So let's just start.
Yes, you're right. And then we can course correct, but we can't,
yeah.
unless we sense and respond. I love it. In the book, you outline this idea of a time management matrix, and it's inspired, at least partially inspired, by Stephen Covey's urgency impact matrix. So this idea mm-hmm. that there are things on one side that are urgent and things on the other side that aren't, and then there are things with high impact at the top and smaller impact below. Mm. How do you propose people use that framework as a line of thinking to prioritize their time.
Yeah, it's such an important thing, because what I've noticed, you may have noticed as well, but over the last 2 years, people have been really, really drawn into kind of getting the easy stuff done, because then they can feel a sense of accomplishment in a world that's gone a little bit crazy around them. And so that's kind of dangerous thinking, because while you might tick off your to-do list with lots of those simple tasks, they haven't necessarily moved you towards achieving the bigger, more important contribution to that North Star, if you like. So when thinking about it in your role, particularly for leaders, you know, what is the most impactful things you can do? Where do you add value? What are the things that you can do that nobody else can do? You know, that's your role as a leader. And so when you think about how you use your time, it's about firstly understanding what are those impactful things, you know, and if you have to, write them down, you know, start somewhere with something that you've actually got to work with, and then make decisions about where you spend your time and how much of it. And so there's the upfront decision of I'm going to work on this rather than this. But then there's also the in the moment decision when someone comes and interrupts you, because that still happens, whether mm-hmm. it might not be a face-to-face interruption, but the interruptions are still coming, is to make a decision in the moment. Is the interruption more important in terms of the impact and value than what I was already working on? And so just being really conscious of that decision-making about where do I invest myself? And I say to leaders all the time, you are so valuable. You're such a valuable resource and asset. You have to invest yourself wisely. And that's about being really conscious of making those choices, you know, the big picture choice, but then the in the moment choice about where you spend your time. And that doesn't mean I have to do back to back really, really important stuff, because we need breaks and we need variety and all of those things. Mm-hmm. But it is about making conscious choices. You know, your choice might be, hey, I've done this piece of work, I'm going to have a break, and I'm going to go and play, you know, play with the kids. In my case, it might be jump in the pool with the kids, right? Mm-hmm. That's good. I'm resourcing myself. I'm having connection and fun with my family. And then, you know, an hour later or however long, I can come back and fully focus on the next piece of important work that I have to do that makes a difference. So it's about being understanding, you know, what's in your realm, what's in your responsibility, and where you make the difference, and then making the choices to make that happen.
So one of the challenges when we frame the idea in this particular matrix at the top right is where we should be focusing our time, yes, is there are, I'm sort of corrupting the model a little bit, but just bear with me, that I'm sort of exploring a theme between complicated and complex. Mm-hmm. So the realm where we can think through the future and really sort of, you know, have some time alone and think through using our expertise on what the next 5 years should look like is very mm-hmm. different from the experimental realm in the complexity in part. Mm-hmm. You led off saying that because the last 2 years have been so tumultuous, we tend to move over to away from the top right and maybe to the top left or even to the bottom where things are chaotic. Mm. If the world is changing really quickly, does that adjust where we should focus our time? Is there some flexibility there? Or is it always a question of, no, we should be driving ourselves towards the top right because that's where the true value of leadership is?
Yeah. My opinion, I think top right, high impact, not yet urgent. And when I say not yet urgent, that's about completion. And completion within whatever the time frame is that you've designated for it. I did a lot of research back in 2020 about great leadership during emergency, catastrophe, disaster, that sort of thing. And one of the themes that came out across masses of research and evidence was that there are three things that great leaders do really well during emergency. And the number one thing is they focus specifically and only on the important. Mm-hmm. They don't get drawn into the minutiae. They don't get drawn into other people's jobs. They don't get drawn into the, the frantic response that has no actual value because it's very unfocused and you know, it's kind of that fright response or the freeze, you know, we don't do anything. And so that for me just really confirmed that top right, focus specifically and only on the important. So know what that is. And yes, what that is may change because the circumstances have changed. So know what it is and reassess frequently, but make sure you're adding value by staying up there.
Okay. So related to that is this idea that people have personal styles, you know, they have a preference for how they operate and they may come up against a circumstance where they've been promoted and it, you know, what was adaptive in your previous role is not adaptive in your new role. Mm-hmm. How can individuals recognize that in themselves and adjust accordingly?
Okay, so the first thing is to actually know that about yourself. So observe where and how you do your best work and what you enjoy and all of those sorts of things. So that would be the first thing I would say. But the second thing is recognize also that as you progress through a career, particularly a leadership career, you need to broaden your toolkit. You know, being the expert at whatever it was, sales, marketing, programming, you know, engineering, whatever it is, being the expert is not enough to then lead that domain or lead the people in that domain. And so we've got to broaden out our toolkit. So understanding what else do I need so that I'm feeling equipped and comfortable to actually transition into that new role with new ways of adding value. So it's not about me doing all the doing anymore. It's about me, you know, supporting the people and leading the people who are doing the doing. And so I think that you may have seen this yourself, that there are still lots of situations where people get promoted because they're really good at what they do. Then they don't get the support to broaden out that leadership toolkit, management and leadership toolkit. In fact, no one probably even has a conversation with them to let them know there's a difference between those two roles and what they need to bring to them. And so for me, that means there's a lot of opportunity to help people, you know, to help them develop their leadership so that they can take their strengths and they can take the things that they've learned and experienced, but then apply them in a new way in their, you know, leadership capacity, however far up that leadership hierarchy they end up. And I think that that way, what we do is kind of create the best of both worlds.
Are you familiar with a show called Silicon Valley? Speaking of frittering away your time on Netflix.
I think I might've heard of it, but I've never watched it.
One of the themes in it is that the founder of the company, who's just really an expert on computer programming, develops a compression algorithm. And it's such an amazing compression algorithm that a company is born. Mm-hmm. And as they raise funds and raise funds and raise funds, eventually he gets to the point where they replace him as CEO, mm-hmm. and he becomes CTO. So second in command, just really focusing on the technology. And mm-hmm. this is not uncommon with startups, right? You'll often see that somebody who founded the company is no longer leading the whole thing, but leading a part of it because it plays their expertise. Is that a positive outcome or is that a failure of growth? Or how do we know when somebody should be coached beyond, you know, just having the technical role and becoming the CEO? This is a microcosm in all companies, right? Mm-hmm. The question is, should you stay where you are or should you grow into a bigger role? How do you calibrate for that?
I think that largely, I think it is case by case. There are some people who they just want to be the expert. They want to be the best expert they can be in their space, which is amazing and great, and we should embrace that. And they'll have thought leadership in their space and they'll have mastery in the space and quality and all those sorts of things. And so if that's what they want to do, we need to find ways to actually embrace that and support them and create, you know, potential progression, you mm-hmm. know, into that most senior expert role. There are other people who are also going to be, you know, really great as the expert, but they have the desire and the potential to actually transition that or morph that into more of a leadership role. And I think the first thing is we actually need to recognize it.
Right.
Have the conversations with people about what they want. Do a bit of exploration and discovery with them. Maybe even try it out. And if it doesn't work, you know, if you get promoted, someone gets promoted as a leader and you kind of want to see how it goes, both of you want to see how it goes, and maybe it doesn't work or it doesn't feel comfortable or they don't enjoy it, then there's actually an option to go back into the expert path. And I think that that can be a bit of a lack in some organizations, that someone is put into a leadership role, they don't succeed, and so we get rid of them, as opposed to offering them an alternative pathway that really plays to what they want to do. I think case by case, but I also think we need to have options and opportunities in all those pathways.
Yeah, that's sort of the cause of the Peter principle, right? Is that this idea that you get promoted to the point of incompetence? It's because very rarely will anybody, whether it's the person in charge of that person or that person, admit that maybe if they'd just gone lateral or even a step down, they'd have much happier outcomes. It's tough because there aren't too many organizations that really promote the idea of demoting people.
Yeah, but I guess it's about how it's viewed. I did, when I was doing one of my coaching certifications, I had to do some research on finding a story to tell. And the story that I ended up writing was about a gentleman called Patrick McCarthy, who is world famous in Nordstrom and customer service kind of circles. So short story. So back in the 70s, he was a salesman in the gentleman's clothing department at Nordstrom's, and he was very good at it. And very quickly, when he was in his 20s, he, you know, became the highest performer. And so he was promoted to the sales manager of that department. And 18 months later, he said, "Not for me. I want to go back and sell clothes. You know, that's what I'm good at. I'm really great with customers and that sort of thing." And so, as they say, the rest is history. So he went on to become the first salesperson at Nordstrom's to sell $1 million. He was the top salesman 15 out of 30 years. He and somebody else wrote the Nordstrom Way, which is still like a customer service Bible. So, you know, there are pathways, right? But I thought at that time, what an amazing thing that Nordstrom's did to actually allow him to go, I'm not a manager. I don't want to be the manager. I'm really good at this other thing. And they allowed him to do that.
Yeah. It's a lot of awareness on both parts, isn't it?
Yeah.
I love it. So that brings us to the question of partly why it's so fraught, but also why it's so important, seeking feedback on your own effectiveness as a leader. Because there's always the possibility that you'll be told, "No, you're not very effective," which isn't comfortable, and it may have consequences you don't like. But
yeah.
So how should I go about that?
Tough one, right? Feedback.
Yes.
We've all had the experience that we didn't enjoy around feedback. So again, for me, it's very much about creating opportunity. You know, feedback should not be a weapon that's used with people. You know, it's an opportunity. It's a gift, and then it's about what do we do with that gift. So, in principle, it is about when you go into that kind of feedback situation. I think it's really important to understand, like, what's my purpose and intent here, and to have a positive intent. You know, not to be, "Oh, I've got to get rid of this person because they're not performing." It's about, okay, ask yourself, what do I want? I want a great outcome. I want a great outcome for them. I want them to be comfortable and performing. And yes, that's going to be good for me and the organization and the team. But, you know, you really need to come from that place, I believe, in order to get a positive outcome out of the situation, out of the conversation. So that would be the first thing, positive intent going in. But the second thing is about how you frame it, you know, because I could have a leader who's not yet performing. You know, they may not be doing well for lots of reasons. But if I frame the conversation in a way that doesn't create opportunity, then that performance isn't going to change. If I frame the conversation where it creates opportunity, a couple of things may happen. The performance may improve because now they've got some insight. and some action to take. They may recognize that actually it's not for them after all. And so let's look at the other, you know, career pathways there might be. Or what else? They try and it doesn't quite work, but at least they all know they've tried. And so now let's look at plan B. And so I think really the most simple way I would say is start off with the positive side, get in that resourceful space. What is working well? That would be my question. What is working well?
Oh, sorry. Am I cutting you off?
Can I continue? Yeah. So that would be the first thing. What's working well? Because we don't want to smash them, right? To begin with, we start with that. And then I would be asking them what would make it even better. Mm-hmm. And then we can contribute about what we think might make it even better. All right. So we've got a baseline of what's working. And now how do we build on that? And so what would make it better? And it might be about communication. It might be about organization. It might be about relationship building, whatever it is. And so that then creates the opportunity. So if this would make it better, what are you going to work on? How are you going to do that? What kind of help do you need? Right. And so we go from there. And so it's all about keeping the potential alive and creating options and opportunity.
So the way we're discussing it now is initiated by the person, the man or the leader of the person who is addressing the feedback.
Yep.
In the book, you gave the leader more agency, which was to seek feedback.
Absolutely.
And I'm wondering how to construct that, because that is an act of bravery, I think.
It is an act of bravery, but again, help yourself out. What I hear from a lot of leaders is they go, you know, I ask my team for feedback and they don't give me much. They tell me it's fine or it's good.
Right.
And the question they ask is, can you give me some feedback? And, hey, if I'm working for you and you ask me that question, that's pretty confronting and I haven't thought about it. And do I really want to tell you what I think? It's pretty tough. So as the person wanting to gain feedback, I would say, again, what's your intention? Are you trying to learn? Are you trying to understand what's working? Where the opportunities are? You know, figure that out. And then when you go into the conversation, ask more specific questions. Yeah. What did you think about this morning's meeting? What worked for you? What would have made it better? It could be about, again, all those topics, relationship, communication, but be specific with your questions. And let them know, why are you doing this as a leader? That gives them some context. They don't have to have that fear. If you say something like, hey, I'm pretty focused on developing my own leadership. And what would be really helpful for me is to get some more information to kind of put into my information pot so that I know what would be useful. And then they have some context. So it's not about you trying to get them in trouble or find out who likes you and who doesn't like you, or, you know, any of those kind of things. Yeah. Give them some context, again, positive intent. And ask specific questions about what you really want to know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. I mean, timely, granular feedback is so much easier to act on.
Absolutely. And it's kind of closer to the moment. You know, if I tell you, you know, the old sporting analogy, if you run off the field at full time and the coach tells you all the things that could have happened, it's too late. The game's finished.
Yes.
Same with 6-monthly or annual feedback.
Yes.
It's too late.
Absolutely. If we were playing a video game and it only told you at the end what your score was, I don't think anybody would play it.
Yeah.
You don't have a clue how well you're doing.
Absolutely. Yeah. So you might get some in enjoyment out of it, but you get so much more if you hate.
Yeah, I'm actually
know what's going on. And I know how to react and respond.
Yes. So the last 2 years have not only changed how we work, but, you know, where we work and the conditions. So some people are working from home, some are hybrid. Some even just where they work has changed. You know, there's plexiglass or we're 6 feet apart or whatever. How should leaders think through their physical space to organize it to work on their effectiveness?
I think the first thing is they actually do need to think through it. I'm not sure that many leaders have. They had their space in the office and then they quickly had a space at home in lots of cases and they just kind of landed somewhere in the house or the apartment, you know, and it didn't have a lot of thought. We're 2 years in, it's time to think about it. And so that's the first thing. Just you know, is it set up? Have you got... one of my favorites is just the height of your camera, for example, because we're all you know, on Zoom and Hangouts and all that sort of thing. So, you know, make sure people are seeing you, you know, straight on. They're not looking down at you. They're not looking up at you because you've got your camera or your webcam at not the right height.
Right.
So simple stuff like that. So physically, have you got... the equipment that you need to actually do your job in all of your locations? And if you have to move between locations, how much of that equipment do you need to take with you to be functional, you know, when you get there? Do you have enough physical space, working space? You know, do you, is it super cluttered? Do you need to declutter some of the stuff? It's keep it pretty simple, I think, but actually think about it.
Yeah,
is the big thing. And when you have to transfer from locations, what do you need? What's your kind of go bag to get from one to the other?
I love it. It's like what do they call it? Doomsday prepper. We need to be a doomsday work prepper. Yeah. Another form of clutter is our calendars. You mentioned earlier, you know, this idea that somehow people manage to interrupt you even when you're at home. One of the magical thing of our age is it's always the phone or the text message or the you know, the pop-up in Teams or whatever. There's always some way to get a hold of you very quickly. And it's really hard to concentrate on that top right quadrant, that time where you're actually thinking on things that have high value. So what do we do about that? How do we address that? Because some cultures don't reward or more to the point, emphasize people being able to respond quickly.
Yeah. Of course, it does depend to some degree on the nature of your industry and the type of work that you're doing in terms of how responsive you need to be, just to address that. So if you're in emergency services, there's a different level of responsiveness to, working in, the bank's transactions, you know. So I think that firstly, again, go back to basics. What is it that you need to be doing to be making the most impact? And how much of your time throughout the week do you want to dedicate to that? And it's not going to be all the time, because we can't work on, you know, that most important stuff at our best all the time. So there's a component of that. Then there's a component of just, you know, what I'd call admin-y kind of stuff, you know, processing your email and, you know, those things that need to be done because some important work comes out of that. But making really clear decisions about even simple things like that, you know, how often do I actually need to check my email? It probably isn't every 15 minutes, you know, which with phones and that sort of thing, people do. They're always on them checking. It's just wasting your time, you know. Actually check it with discipline, take the work from it and figure out when you're going to do it, and then leave it alone and get some work done. And I guess the other thing is to understand what is that responsiveness that's required. What I find when I work with people, I had a number of years as a productivity consultant, so this was really drummed into me, and all the evidence shows for people who maybe check their email once or twice, possibly even three times each day, in that really disciplined way, and they process it, they actually do something with it, their response time is actually less than people who check it, you know, like every half an hour, because those people check it, but they don't do anything with it. Right?
Yeah.
So there's a real difference in that. So it's a discipline. So that's the first thing. And then I think in terms of being connected to our people and that sort of thing, and the interruptions is, you know, let people know when you're most available, when they're most likely to catch you, and have a period or a couple of periods in your day which are sort of set aside for that. And you can have work to do, but it's not that deep, intensive work where you need to really focus for an hour at a time. Maybe it's the bits and pieces work, and you do that, but you are, you know, you're available, if you like, to answer messages and take calls and that sort of people. So people know if they want to catch you, that's the best time to do it. Yeah. And then the final thing, of course, is to manage expectations. You know, it is not reasonable, in my opinion, that people send an email and expect a response within 10 minutes. If it's that important, find another way to let me know it's that important, because, you know, I'm not sitting at my desk waiting just for your email.
Well said. So let's talk a little bit about a phrase you use in your book, which is operating in your zone of genius. I love the sound of that. So how do we identify it, and how do we pursue it?
Yeah, great. And there's lots of ways of doing this. This is just a really nice, simple way of unpacking it. For me, your zone of genius is that space where you're really operating in your potential, where, you know, you get into flow. We've all had those moments where it's just easy. We make progress, we enjoy it, and we're just in that space where stuff happens, time kind of disappears. And we want to get as much of that as possible, because that's when we're making our biggest contribution, really. And so there are three key areas that I look at. And the first is just to really understand, what do you know? So that's skills, experience, competence, all of those things. What do you know? And it doesn't have to be just the stuff you do at work. There's loads of other knowledge and experience that you have from all other facets of your life. So what do you know? Unpack that, brainstorm it out. The second thing is, what do you love? So what do you get enjoyment from? You know, what do you get satisfaction, a sense of achievement? Where do you feel most energized? What are all those things? And there's going to be some, you know, some intersection points.
Hopefully,
right?
That's what
yes. we're trying to create, yeah? And again, not just about work, all facets of your life. You know, what do you love? And to give you an example, I was working with someone who was quite worked in a role where they pretty much could work on their own. And they were good at their job, but feeling flat. And what they loved is in their local community football club, they were some kind of convener anyway. And so they were interacting with people and organizing things, and it was all about the connection with other people, which they didn't have in their job. And so understanding that then creates opportunity. Yeah, does that make sense? So what do you know? What do you love? And then the final one is, how can you contribute? So how can you add value? How can you work towards your goals, the organization's goals, the vision? Where do you make a difference? What's the unique stuff that you can actually help with? And so, again, intersection points. And so what we want to overlay is, we want to know, what do you love? What do you know? How can you contribute? And when all those things are in play together, then you're operating in your zone of genius.
I love it. Okay. It sort of reminds me of, if you're in the product design space, this idea of desirability, feasibility, and viability. This question of, you know, does somebody want it? Can we do it? And can we make money doing it?
Yeah.
And so, it's very related to the, I think it's pronounced ikigai, this idea that there's sort of this thing that speaks to your soul and provide you get, lets you make the most value for the world. So what a wonderful way to sort of frame. You can't always get that in the job you have, but at least you can, that can inform what you look for in your next role, maybe in the same company or beyond.
Look, absolutely. I think we all recognize there are components that or things that we're going to have to do that are not ideal. We wouldn't choose.
Unalloyed joys. Yeah.
but we want to create a balance that we can live with of the things that we do love and we do want to do versus the things that, okay, they just kind of go with the territory. My dad, who's a great influence on me, said that people, to get the best out of your people, you want them to 70% of the time be using their skills and knowledge. 70% of the time be working with people they like, and 70% of the time feel like they're making a difference. And if you can get to that 70% threshold, then, you know, you got a good opportunity.
It might not be the same 70%.
No, it might not. Yeah.
So when a leader coaches members of their team, so let's get into the sort of the coaching mindset, this idea that we're helping people develop. What are the goals of me as a leader coaching my team?
Lots of goals. The big thing is you want them to learn and grow because then they can contribute more. You look amazing, right? No, the coaching is about building capability and accountability. Right? We've all heard conversation where a leader has said, I just really need my team to step up, or I wish someone would show some initiative, or, you know, like we've all heard it. And so coaching is about creating that. It's about moving everything from sitting on the leader's shoulders, if you like, where they have to make all the decisions, they have to drive everything, they have to make sure it happens, to actually creating opportunity for others to be accountable, you know, and to really own how things happen, and in that process to learn and grow so they become more equipped for the next time. And if we can have more leaders doing coaching, what they're doing actually is scaling the impact that they can actually have as a leader, because now it's not, you know, a capacity of one, them, it's a capacity of them and all the people they coach.
Yeah, it's a terrific lever. You're absolutely right. So you talked a bit about using questions as a way to initiate coaching. Can you offer a couple of examples of questions that would open up a productive dialogue?
Yeah, depending on how it starts, of course, we want to start at the beginning, which is, what are you trying to do here? Mm-hmm. What do you want to happen? You know, let's actually understand what the task is or the goal is. And from there, then we can start to ask more open questions. And that's the secret. Ask the open question. You know, what, how, when, who, where, and open up the conversation as opposed to closing it down with closed questions. So what we want to, I guess, be thinking about as the leader is not to be giving the answer, but to be trying to actually help the other person to find the answer.
Right. Yeah, I like that. It's so tempting to be clever and provide an answer with a question, right?
Yeah.
But you really need to be open about it.
Yeah.
What are the signs that somebody's leadership is failing?
Again, so many. It could be obviously there's performance perhaps in the team. It could be the culture in the team, could be turnover in the team. It could be that just the level of communication, connection, all of those things starts to dip, perhaps from the individual. It could be, gosh, just the level of angst and that sort of thing that's happening around them or in their team. There's no one factor, is there? There's lots of things.
Yeah, that you but I like the way you started out. It was, you're sort of talking about the early warning signs, right?
Yeah.
The turnover is a big one.
Yeah, it is. But typically that would take a while.
Yeah.
But then what you start to see is a real pattern happening. I think... Yeah, there's so many ways it can show up, and it depends where the lack of performance, you know, how is it? Is it, if a leader's not performing, it could be because they're actually not leading, they're not giving any direction or vision, they're not setting a tone for their part of the organization. Or it could be their communication really isn't where it needs to be, or they haven't built a relationship with their team. You know, so there's so many ways in which we may not be stepping up as a leader, and it will then show up in so many other factors. I think the important thing is that as a leader and as a leader of leaders, we just need to keep our finger on the pulse and we need to be observant.
Yeah. So in your bio on LinkedIn, you mentioned one of your many roles as mentor. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, is that deliberately distinct from coach? How do those roles differ?
Yeah. It is deliberately distinct from coach. So the way that I look at it is when I'm coaching someone, what I'm trying to do is to bring out their best. They've got great knowledge and experience and skills and thinking and strengths. And so that's my role, is to help them to use and tap into all of that great stuff they have and to apply it to whatever their situation is or their thinking to find a way forward. There are going to be some circumstances in which the person simply doesn't know the answer. They haven't encountered anything like this before. They simply don't know. And it's not a throwaway, I don't know the answer. It's genuinely, I don't know. And for me, that's where mentoring comes in. So mentoring is them tapping into my experience and, you know, wisdom and knowledge and that sort of thing, maybe because I've got different experience to them. And so mentoring is about my story, my guidance, the things that I can contribute to them to broaden their own knowledge set, their own potentially insights. But then I would still, you know, I go back into coaching mode. That's just me, is to go, well, now that you've got this extra knowledge or information, what would you like to do? So it's still, it's not me saying, I think you should do this, although there will be some mentors who would do that. I prefer to, from a mentoring perspective, share, you know, some information that may be useful, but then still have them make those choices, because I think that's really important when we're trying to create ownership or accountability for whatever it is. And this, these are very senior people, you know, mm-hmm. we're people in the C-suite. They still need to own it, right? I don't want them coming back going, I did what you told me to do and it didn't work.
Yeah, it's your fault.
You know, right. So it has to be, and I'm very happy to share this knowledge with you. However, you know, at the end of the day, this is about what you want to do or what you choose to do or how you choose to think about it. So from here, where do you want to go? But the mentoring is about relying on my expertise. The coaching is about relying on their expertise.
So let me try to echo that to see if I understand it. So that last part really did help delineate it, but I'm trying to visualize what the mentorship looks like. So you would be perhaps sharing anecdotes of successes or even failures that you've had at a vista mm-hmm. that they don't share. And so Absolutely. You've seen things that they haven't seen.
Correct.
You can bring that perspective, because this is what's on the other side of the horizon. When you achieve what you're capable of now, there's going to yes. be another vista.
Yes, absolutely. And so a great colleague of mine, Jane Anderson, talks about when it comes to mentoring and finding a mentor, you need a mentor for right now, the right mentor for right now. And that's because typically with a mentoring, you know, if we're talking about kind of a formal mentoring relationship, is the person who is the right mentor for you is someone who's already done what you're trying to do.
Yeah.
They've got the experience and the expertise, and they've had the situations that have faced them and those sorts of things. And so that's what you're drawing on to help you take that or a similar kind of journey. And so over 12 months, you've had that mentor perhaps. Now it's time for a new mentor, because now you've got the next big horizon that you're going for. But yeah, the role of the mentor is really to bring that wealth of experience in whatever the facet is that we're focused on, and bring that to the individual to tap into.
What are your feelings on official mentorship programs in large organizations? Do they work well? How can they be structured to be effective?
I think some are amazing. Some are less amazing. It's like anything, you know. The first thing I think is to be really clear about what's our purpose. What are we actually trying to do with the program? And staying true to that. So making sure that we've got the right candidates in the program, that we've got the right mentors in the program, that the matching process is solid. You know, in mentoring, like many of these relationships, chemistry is important. Mm-hmm. You know, there needs to be connection and relationship between the mentor and the mentee. And so, and then we also need to make sure, and I think this is where some programs fall down, we need to make sure that the mentors have sufficient training as mentors. Mm-hmm. That they actually know how to, you know, guide the process, guide the conversation so that they are purposeful.
Yeah.
And useful. And so I think what can happen is we have these, you know, great people with incredible experience. We say, hey, would you like to come and be part of our mentoring program? And then we just drop them in. And like anything, it's like if they haven't mentored before or they haven't been taught to mentor, they have some really great conversations, but they perhaps aren't the right conversations to be having in the context of that mentoring program. So I think there's a lot of value in you know, a well-run, well-structured program with well-equipped mentors.
So you said something interesting earlier that got the wheels turning, and that is that the mentor is somebody who's been down the road you're going. Mm. And of course, there's a presumption there, right? You know, we talked earlier about the possibility that the next rung up for you is not right for you.
Mm.
How can the mentor and mentee explore that tension and think through, well, maybe I don't want to go down the same path that you went down? Is that something that naturally comes up in a conversation with a mentor?
Yeah, I would think it does, certainly in the conversations I've had. Yeah, it may be, yeah, this is kind of similar and this is kind of similar, but then you went and did this and I don't really want to do that. I want to go and do something else. That's okay. Let's talk about it.
Useful outcome.
Yeah. But also, you know, it's not just about the mentor's personal experience. It's also about what they've seen.
Mm.
Yeah. You know, what's happened around them, the experience that they've had, the mentors that they've had, you know, so it's not just an experience set of one, you know, the mentor brings much more than that.
Okay. Yeah. That I can see that. You've been at tables that they haven't been invited to yet, that kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Most people lead from within, not the tippy top of an organization. How can we affect and influence corporate culture around us, even if we don't own the whole thing?
Show up every single day. Everything you do has an influence. You know, I think that people underestimate the difference that they can make, you know, as being, you know, one person. If you're in a leadership role, yes, that will potentially cascade around, you know, around you and upwards. I think that, you know, and sideways to your peers. I don't underestimate the impact that you can have. And so it is about how you show up. It is about your behavior. It is about what you model. And I think that's a really big one that I talk to leaders about, is whether they realize it or not, they're role modeling every single day, every single moment, whether I can see you or not. You know, it is about how visible you are online and things like that, and how communicative you are, and you know, how your decisions are made, and how you know you organize your team or bring them together. There's so many things that you can do. So you're role modeling every day, and I think if you take ownership of that and you recognize that, then that will then start to get you thinking about how you are actually showing up, and lo and behold, now you're starting to actually make a difference.
Yeah, I love that. As you have said often today, it's about really thinking through what the impact of what you're doing is. I love that. So this has been fantastic. I'm down to the last question. Mm-hmm. Your latest book is called You're on Mute, which I love that title. It's so timely. How do you advise users to show up online with credibility and confidence? How can you project your best self and your best work online?
Yeah. Again, a big question. I think there's a couple of facets to it. So the first one is, as leaders, is actually to come to terms with the fact that this is a whole new skill set, not just for ourselves, but for our organizations. Just logging into Zoom or whatever platform you use, but logging into Zoom is not enough. You know, we have to become proficient at it, so that the technology and the mode that we're using doesn't get in the way of the connection and the trust and all of those things. So the first thing I would say is actually recognize the importance of being proficient and building your skill set and helping others around you to do the same. And then the second one is also recognizing that organizationally we have to operate differently. Yeah. And that means that we have to strategically figure out how do we keep our business operating effectively, regardless of the changing, you know, circumstances and situations, whether we're in lockdown, whether the borders are closed, whether, you know, we now have a flexible workforce, all of those sorts of things. I mean, I've seen everything from organizations who've been spectacular in the way that they've created connection and communication online during the last 2 years, to those who have said, oh no, we're not having a leadership team get together until we can be face to face. And 18 months later, the leadership team hasn't been together in any kind of strategic forum. How do you create the future for your business? So it's actually coming to terms with it and not hoping it will go away, because it's not going away. So we need to have that strategic approach. And then we also need to equip ourselves at the individual level.
Yeah, I love that strategic. And then also considering the human element is so important. Stacey, thank you so much for being on the show. This was great.
Oh, my great pleasure. Thank you for having me.
My guest today was Stacey Ashley. A link to Stacey's website and her LinkedIn profile will be in the show notes. My name is Tim Hampton, and you can reach me at tim@unusuallywellinformed.com. Thanks for listening. I hope you will subscribe and join me for the next show with another unusually well-informed leader in business and technology.
Thank you for listening to the Unusually Well-Informed podcast. The opinions expressed by the host and guests on the Unusually Well-Informed podcast are their own and do not reflect that of their employer or any other affiliation.